digital precursor of modern day digital currencies like Bitcoin.
This is the live one.
He's worked with the US Department of Defense on disaster relief and state failure issues, and helped develop a cheap ID card for the NSA for use in disaster zones. His attention is currently turned to global disaster prevention, and you're probably best known as the inventor of the XDR. Over to you, Lina.
Hi. Is that the... Okay. So, I'm also working with Ethereum these days, which you'll be hearing about later on.
Yep.
These are the live ones. Sorry. Okay, so... this is going to be kind of hard going, but I want to try and talk about how the world actually works so that we can then assess where these threats actually are and how they apply to us. Right? So this is a kind of brutal approach, and I apologize, but we got 10 minutes to get the truth. We're just going to do it. A third of the people that will die this year will die of poverty and causes directly related to poverty, roughly one in three. That's a few million from indoor air pollution, from smoky cooking fires. It's a few million from dirty water. It's a million or so from malaria. It's a million or so from malnutrition. And pretty soon you get to a third of the people that will die of these kind of causes. All of those deaths are completely preventable within a tiny fraction of the existing global spending on advertising, never mind the existing global spending on arms. And to keep the systems in place which cause to these deaths requires a constant application of violence from the former colonial powers. So the US has been more or less continuously at war to defend its natural resource extraction base outside of US territorial borders, really since World War II. So most recently, you've got the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. You go back before that, there was 30 years of death squads in South America assassinating union leaders. You go back before that, there's a wave of political assassinations in Africa in the post-colonial period to prevent things like Pan-Africanism taking root. Go and take a look at the Wikipedia list of assassinated African political leaders. Go and look at the US death squad history in South America. Today we have the flying robot death squads. Inside of that kind of system, which I refer to as ongoing economic genocide, you don't really get much discussion in rich countries of where the wealth comes from. You hear a bit of discussion about civil rights in China because we're all using these devices that were manufactured there, right? And you know something about these horrendous standards of living and a kind of state socialist system which will basically kill anybody that tries to organize a union, that will beat workers into submission if they try and protest for better standards of living. We're all completely dependent on this system. The discussions that we're having about freedom are being conducted on devices that were made by slaves, and there is no fair trade laptop. There is Fairphone, which is a really good first step, but we are completely enmeshed in the second order effect of colonialism, which we now call capitalism. However you want to discuss the international order. So when you take technologies like the wireless telescreen, right? Everything envisaged from Big Brother in 1984 in your pocket, right? And you couple them with a regime which is using drones, which include cameras that are capable of face recognition, to assassinate people on shaky evidence thousands of miles away with the pilots sitting safely in bunkers in Virginia, there's really not much further to go. The fact that these drone attacks are not happening on European or American soil yet is the only thing that divides us from the understanding that we operate inside of a system which is fundamentally genocidal and fascist. This is where we actually are. If you think any different, go to the facts. Look at what's happened. Go to any of the checklists on what constitutes fascism, look at the mortality statistics country by country by country. Direct correlation between skin color and life expectancy. Right? Now, what we've seen from Snowden is the very substantial probability that the NSA has compromised most of the devices that we use at a hardware level at point of manufacture. It's fairly obvious, if you look at the material that's come out so far, that the logical next step is there are only two companies in the world that produce microprocessors in any kind of quantity, And by the application of national security letters, you could force them to compromise the microprocessors or point of manufacture. In all probability, the Intel and the ARM processors are compromised, which means all of the software that we are talking about writing to provide us liberty is completely flawed, because should the government want to get at whatever is being sent by your PGP message, if they can't get through your operating system and they can't get through your Wi-Fi, eventually they will get through your processor. In all probability, we do not have the evidence yet, but it's very hard to imagine from what we know so far that the next step was not to go directly after Intel. And if they did go directly after Intel, as far as software-based responses to this stuff, it is very much an interim step, if that. And do not forget that we won the Second World War largely on our ability to hide the fact that we had broken Enigma. The first trick that the state learned involving cryptography was to not reveal what you have broken to your enemies. And right now, it should be fairly apparent from the general trend, the state is treating us increasingly as if we are those enemies. So you put all of this stuff together, you really have to sit back and think for a moment. Right, all of the discussions we're having about this stuff are operating in an environment which is completely different to the acceptable terms of political discourse. Right? I take a huge personal risk every time I start talking about economic genocide and ongoing fascism. Every time I use the term flying robot death squads, I'm sticking my neck out. Right? Not so much because I believe the state will come down on me, I don't think the state cares, but because it's so far outside of the political discourse that we comfort ourselves with, that if you use these kind of terms, people think that you are nuts. Even if you point to the data, the risk is that people will think that you are nuts. Right? But you look at the news the same as I do, you just won't connect the points, because when you draw the line, the conclusion is so incredibly unpleasant. The American government are actively working on ground combat robots. The company that is furthest ahead in manufacturing those robots was Boston Dynamics, but it's now owned by Google. So Google is manufacturing the advanced ground combat robot prototypes for the US government, and they're reading your email. So you take automated surveillance from the wireless telescreens and automated enforcement from the upcoming ground combat robots, you tell me what kind of a society you're going to get. Until you politically organize to stop these processes at source, all of the technology which is being deployed around you is building a cage, and as soon as that system matures to the point where the cage can be locked, you're going to find yourselves in a very different world, and you're going to wound up in a place you really don't like. There is no form of political radicalism which is too extreme when it comes to defense of liberty in a scenario like this, and that is the scenario that you're in. So my contention is that until we force the state back inside of safe boundaries, we are all in imminent danger of living the rest of our lives in a kind of digital dictatorship of the kind that 1984 was simply a first order prediction of. And on current evidence, that digital dictatorship will be astonishingly racist, because the existing economic system is astonishingly racist, and it is at the heart of the dictatorship which is being built one layer at a time. Let us hope that it is never completed. And whether it is or not is largely up to me and you. Thank you.
Surveillance is A-OK. It's not mass surveillance, or not bulk surveillance, bulk collection of data.
Yeah, bulk data collection.
Bulk data collection was perfectly fine, okay? Because that's not mass surveillance. What's your response to that?
Well, I think, and I said this in my evidence session, I think we can agree to disagree on that. For me, and I know there's some people in this audience that don't necessarily agree with me, but targeted investigations, for me, fine. Mass surveillance, not acceptable. And I think for me, bulk data and mass surveillance is just an issue of semantics. The difference in opinion seems to be with me, whether you're gathering if you gather the information but promise to not look at it, that's just as intrusive as gathering the information and looking at it. I think the threat of having your communications read, but the government promising to not read them, doesn't make any difference. That's going to change human behaviour in terms of how they communicate. And I think in a democracy, that for me just isn't acceptable. But the most unacceptable thing that we've found from not just the ISC report, this ISC report, but the ISC report into the murder of Fusilier Lee Rigby, was that the security services and law enforcement are absolutely failing to deal with the data that they currently have. They're not joined up. They're not talking to each other properly. They're not monitoring the 2,000 to 3,000 people that they've identified as being a threat, an ongoing and serious threat to this country in an acceptable manner, because they're not resourced properly. Yet they're asking to get access on a legal basis to every communication potentially that we make in this country. And that, for me, that just doesn't add up as an argument. If you can't focus in on the people, and they seem pretty good at identifying the people that are a threat. There doesn't seem to be an argument necessarily around that. But in terms of maintaining the response to that, we saw that's why Lee Rigby was murdered. And that's the same thing that we saw with the Charlie Hebdo murders as well. It's not a lack of data that seems to be the problem. It's the lack of resources. But nobody in Parliament, nobody within this committee seemed to be able to stand up and make that argument plainly, even though that's what the reports clearly show. They can write it down in their report that's hidden in 160 pages, but when it comes to press releasing it and talking about it, frankly, within Parliament, nobody seems to have decided that that's the point that needs to be made.
Okay. Vinay and Steve, do you have any comment on that?
Emma, when you say you don't mind targeted surveillance, do you mean target surveillance in general, or do you mean target? Because for me, the distinction would be target surveillance.
With caveats.
Yeah.
Not a free for all.
Yeah. Would you include court?
Excuse me.
Would you include court orders as part of that? So, what process would people have to go through to get? Government agencies.
Well, we're massive advocates of judicial oversight. Is a better safeguard as to what we have at the moment.
FISA in America?
Well, not quite like FISA in America.
It's judicial oversight.
Yeah, it's judicial. It's not a silver bullet, but it makes me incredibly uncomfortable to have people who are politically linked.
Just to clarify, yeah. FISA is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
So it makes it very uncomfortable in this country to have the signing off of warrants for surveillance being so politically linked to ministers, to Secretary of State, who, yes, are democratically accountable to all of us, but they won't tell us what's going on. And they're under political pressure to act.
This is the same institution that used the Official Secrets Act to gag police when they discovered Cyril Smith in a house full of underage rent boys, right? The entire political system that we are in the UK is up to its eyeballs in a variety of grossly illegal activities.
I completely agree with that.
Why would you want them to have the power on the basis that they won't use it? There's no way you can trust them.
I know, I don't want them to have the power to sign off the warrants. I don't want them to have the power to be involved in surveillance. I want that to be taken away from them.
But you're not taking it away from them by giving it to the judiciary or to the police. The judiciary are up to their eyeballs just as much as anybody else.
Well, how would you have it authorised?
I don't think we need it.
You don't think we should have any form of surveillance whatsoever?
If we're interested in saving lives, ban tobacco, right? If you're interested in saving lives, if it is about using government power to save lives, our exposure to death from terrorism is minuscule. Our exposure to death from tobacco is, a million and a half Britons a year or something insane like that, right? Not a million and a half, sorry, that can't be right. But it's certainly something like 30% of UK mortality. Yeah. So if we want to infringe people's civil rights to save their lives, ban tobacco. Terrorism is irrelevant.
So on the same argument, you'd ban cars, you'd ban...
No, if we're just, I'm just saying, if the objective is to save lives, go after tobacco, right? Because the loss of life is 1,000 or 10,000 times what it is from terrorism, and the loss of freedom to protect us from terrorism compared to the loss of freedom to protect us from tobacco is 5 orders of magnitude difference. The inability to buy a packet of cigarettes will harm nobody. To have all of your thoughts at the age of 15 recorded by the government because you emailed them to your friends and trotted out 20 years later when you try and build a political career, are you really sure you want to be in this politics business? You know, you've said some very odd things in the past. You might want to just sit down, right? Because the corruption at the heart of the British establishment that we have seen demonstrated over this whole paedophilia scandal, they've sat on that for 30 years. Is this a political class you want to trust with intimate knowledge of the private lives of every Briton on request, even if it does go through judicial oversight? I think it's a fundamental question of trust in the state.
Emma?
I don't know how to respond to that, in all honesty. I mean, it's just not an argument that I've ever heard before, and so obviously I haven't come equipped to argue against it. I think when you're talking
maybe you should argue for it.
Well, when you're talking about the trust in the state, I think the vast majority of people don't have any trust in the state.
Then let's not give the state this toolkit.
Well, they already have it.
Then let's take it off them.
How do we take that off them?
I would suggest mass civilian use of encryption and a flat ban on government surveillance of individuals.
Well,
and
that is one of the reasons that's one of the reasons why Big Brother Watch is taking GCHQ to the European Court of Human Rights, because for me, as a citizen, for me, as a civil liberties campaigner, that is one of the only ways that we're going to get to the bottom of what's been going on. We've had Liberty and Privacy International who took the security agencies to the Investory Powers Tribunal in a weird Al Capone sort of twist of fate that we found out that the practices of GCHQ only became legal when they put what they were doing into the public domain, which was around the beginning of December 2014, because of the case in the Investory Powers Tribunal. But now it's in the public domain, it's legal. But prior to that, it wasn't illegal. It wasn't legal. So, it's, you know, as an individual...
Is anybody going to go to jail over the fact they were doing all this illegal
stuff? Well, that's the big question. I think one of the things that they're trying, that Privacy International are trying to do is we can now, as individuals, write to GCHQ and ask if you've been placed under surveillance. And if you have been placed under surveillance, and again, this is based on trust, or whether they do actually tell you, they have to write to you and tell you. There's a system of doing this on Privacy International's website. But it's an incredibly interesting first step in this country in terms of finding out what surveillance regime we have. It's embedded, as you've rightly pointed out, in the tools that we're using every day, in our legal system, in our political system. And in terms of trying to change that, it's incredibly difficult. But I would also agree. I'm a massive fan of encryption, and I think, going back to the points I made earlier, having politicians talking about banning encryption who have absolutely no idea what encryption is, how it's used, and the fact that it would bring down fintech if we got rid of it. I think the financial sector would have a lot to say if we started banning encryption, but they don't take that into account when they make flippant comments in press conferences about the fact that encryption only aids and abets terrorists.
Are you willing to come out as an organisation and say that terrorism is irrelevant to most people's lives and it's not a sufficient reason for the loss of liberty that's being applied to stop it?
I mean, we've
fair to say Big Brother Watch has said that.
Yeah, I think we've said that many times. I think, you know, the main point that I tried to make in our evidence to the Intelligence and Security Committee is that no one has ever presented, including in this recent report, any evidence to show that mass surveillance, aka bulk data collection, actually makes us any safer.
But what about targeted
surveillance? No evidence.
What about targeted surveillance?
Well, if we could use the intercept warrants that the intercept evidence that they received in court, then they would, I think there'd be a lot more people locked up than placed under control orders. I would actually like to see the evidence that they get through bulk data collection, aka mass surveillance, being used to prosecute people.
So we make it admissible in this one, some would cause it to be used less.
If we're not using it, we're the only democracy in the world who can't use intercept evidence in court.
I don't think it will help our position if we can.
I disagree.
Because to a large degree, it's solving the wrong problem, right? The active threat that we live under is the threat that the state turns proper nasty, right? I mean, when an American president gets legislation through which gives him the right to select a US citizen to kill without any oversight, right? You know, the executive orders which permit a US president to have one of their citizens murdered are, you know, they're clearly there, they're on paper, they've been used. We have worse problems than terrorism. The risk that the state continues this rightward swing into a position where it puts us all in grave danger for our futures in a kind of Nazi scenario is a far bigger threat than any conceivable terrorism.
Okay, so a question for all three members of the panel then. Since terrorism is such a small problem, how do we go about enabling the populace to understand what a small problem it is to a degree that we don't focus so much disproportionate energy on it?
Well, I mean, I think that this comes from us having a fundamentally distorted world model, right? If you ask me what the big risks are, it's fascists with robots, it's biotechnology getting completely out of control, and it's biological weapons use, right? I'm not even that worried about nuclear weapons. Biological weapons are bedwettingly terrifying, right? And as we build more and more easy technology for working with, you know, molecular biology and synthetic biology, the prospect that somebody will roll out, you know, a small country rolls out, you know, a basement bioweapon that is genuinely deterrent or worse, is very realistic. Right? So because we live inside of this kind of bubble where the media talks to us about safe threats and just will never mention the really dangerous stuff, we get this completely artificial sense of risk and safety that's massively distorted. You know, when people say 4 to 6 degrees of global warming, what they really mean by that is 30 to 50% drop in global food supply, best case. You see? And it's this need to break through the existing world models, to go back to the primary data, to look at numerical evidence, and to deal with the hard cases that gives us the ability to put terrorism into perspective.
Okay, so these are huge issues, okay?
Yes, they are.
How can a single individual do something about it? Stephen, you're working at the coalface of practical stuff that happens on the internet on a daily basis. You're getting takedown notices, and you're having to deal with whether to process them or not. How do you as an individual cope with the greater background to this?
That kind of comes back to what you were speaking about earlier. In my head, I've got these two kind of identities where I've got the radical ideological beliefs I've got, and then I've got this kind of legally trained, systemized view, you know, tied into the rule of law. So whilst I completely distrust the British ruling class, and we won't talk about independence, Scottish independence, but, you know, I've got deep, deep rooted problems with that. I mean, even the Scottish class don't, you know. Don't get me wrong.
I grew up in Hoyk.
Well, yeah, I could tell the accent. But I think for me, it's about, I really struggle to separate, or I've struggled for a long time with how to separate my kind of, I don't want to use the word utopian, but like my ideal scenarios with what I can do on a day-to-day basis. And that's, for me personally, that's why I work in the field of doing, that's why I went to study what I do, because the digital world and these civil liberty issues are massively important. How I would get interested in it and how I would do things are different to what my pals back in Glasgow would do. Because, I mean, you asked a minute ago about how do we get the populace to understand that terrorism isn't the be all and end all. And I don't know if you can, because the answer is they just don't care. They don't give a shit. And I think the real question is how to make them pissed off enough at the government to want to change things, whether that's, you know, whatever ideological position they come from. And I mean, you're seeing that at the moment with party politics, but that's a drop in the ocean compared to what needs to happen for any real change.
So you're an active worker at the coalface. How does somebody who's not involved, somebody in the audience, what can an individual in the audience do to just make one small step towards improving the situation? Step at a time.
Yeah. I find it hard to give answers that don't operate within an existing framework. I mean, for me, it would be join. I mean, you're here for a start. Join organisations like the Open Rights Group, who continually highlight issues about government surveillance. Big Brother Watch. Look around and get involved in that. And the more noise you make about it, the more. I mean, I keep going back to Scotland in my head, which is quite hard to separate yourself from. the Scottish Parliament particularly is, I mean, they run on PR, so if you can hit them PR-wise, if you can make sure that if you go on Twitter and talk about it, if you make sure that you know that you're pissed off, then that's the first step towards anything. But I don't have a more substantive.
There's no blueprint.
No. And I wish there was.
Okay, Vinay, you characterise this as an infrastructure issue and a political establishment issue. Mm. If you take the political establishment out of it, and leave the situation to the marketplace, will matters improve?
There is no marketplace to speak of in these matters, right? What we've learned from the Snowden leaks is that the NSA came to Google and said, you will do our spying for us, and if you mention it, you're all going to jail. So at that point, there is no market. Right? There is a complete interpenetration of the defence and intelligence community with the assets that are generated inside a private enterprise in America. The kind of key concept here is a thing called the defence industrial base, which you can find good Department of Defence reporting on. And you know, the defence industrial base is a single coherent system that is essentially the in-house name for the military industrial complex. Right? Outside of it, you call it military-industrial complex. Inside of it, you call it the defence industrial base. The problem that we're having is a breakdown in relations between democracy and civil society and the defence industrial base. They're acting like they're crazy people. Right? 1991, you get the fall of the Soviet Union. The predominant reason for US defence spending is gone. Rather than halving the budget, declaring world peace, and putting all the technologists back to work building, you know, spaceships to go to Mars in, they fluff the budget, blow up all the additional threats, and then when you finally get 9/11, the machinery takes the last-ditch hope of continuing the budget and wages a bunch of completely irrelevant wars that have been terrible for US national security. Right? There is a sort of long tradition of absolute muppetry located predominantly in the defense procurement system, which is why you get completely useless spending on the F-35. Right? The F-35 is the new American top-line fighter plane, and the problem is it's got 6 million lines of software, it doesn't work properly, you can't fly it in thunderclouds, and the guns don't work. And that's just the beginning of the problem. There's a very good chance that it will never be an effective combat aircraft, and it's eaten like a tenth of the Pentagon budget. Right? This kind of wall of muppetry is the problem. It's incompetence that leads to evil. You know? And in this kind of game, we have to kind of look at this and just be like, right, if we do not expect better behavior from these people, what are our options? Right? You can talk about the kind of cypherpunk plan of encrypt all the things. That's probably a pretty good first line of defense, but one must remember, you can't trust the operating systems, you can't trust complex software, you can't trust the hardware. So encrypt all the things doesn't buy us as much as we'd like it to. It has to come back to civil society pushing back incredibly hard against the core legitimacy of the security state. You guys have massively abused your power. You've waged ridiculous wars that we all knew were stupid when they were started. You sold us this nonsense about Iraq having something to do with 9/11, and then weapons of mass destruction weren't there. We simply need to take every single one of these failures and get rid of the Muppets. And at the end of that, you might be left with a national security state which is small, efficient, and pointed at the actual risks, rather than these sprawling post-Cold War monstrosities, which are doing nothing more than tax farming the you know, ordinary people to build a class of weapons that even the military doesn't want.
But how do you get there? I mean, it's easy for one of the Muppets to say, I will spend $10 billion on a mass surveillance system.
Yeah.
Because computers are magic and they'll find the bad guys.
Yes, but I'll tell you how we get there, right? We, you know, combat liberalism within our midst. We stop talking inside of this extremely narrow range of acceptable political opinion on these matters, right? I mean, this is theoretically about as radical as it gets outside of London squats. Right? And we're talking inside of the same box that you would get on Newsnight. We are defined by the two poles, the Guardian on one side and the Daily Mail on the other. We scarcely go outside of that box. And that box is a cage. It's nonsense. You go and look at, you know, what's happening from the perspective of the poor bastards on the other end of the supply chain, and the structural oppression in the world is completely transparent. You just follow the story of how your Macintosh or your phone was made, and you can learn everything you need to know about economic injustice and colonialism and, you know, the dark side of the market and the interpenetration of war and the security state and all the rest of that stuff. It's in our manufactured goods. It's not as if this stuff is opaque to see, and we need to start talking about it to each other so that we can formulate political strategies that are relative to the real problems we have, rather than existing in this fantasy land that exists between the Guardian to one side and the Daily Mail on the other. That political spectrum is nonsense, which is fed to privileged white people to make them feel better about where their manufactured goods come from.
Okay, so to all three members of the panel then, can we improve this situation by spending our pound in a more ethical way rather than marching on Parliament?
No. No, before I started working where I was, I worked for a company called Amor Group, and I'm pretty sure contractually I'm still obliged not to talk about this, but I will. They got bought over by Lockheed Martin, who are the giant American defence company. Part of this was strategic. They didn't talk about this at the time, but it was plainly obvious that Lockheed Martin had been trying to get access to UK markets for years. They'd been rebuffed because of the concerns that the American government would then be able to get access to data of UK citizens through the Patriot Act. But now we've got a situation where Lockheed Martin has bought out this technology firm that was independent. The newspapers didn't bat an eyelid at this. Nothing in the Guardian about, you know, the software that the company was producing was for the NHS Scotland, NHS UK. So now, access to that data. So even to go back to that question, even if you do spend your pound ethically, it doesn't matter because your data is already slurped up through. I mean, even forgetting Snowden stuff, the market's already slurped up all your data through acquisitions and mergers and. American companies getting access to your source.
So even if you didn't have the corrupt global political establishment?
Well, that's a big that's a big statement, but I mean, will that solve the problem in the first place? But when you said, when you refer to the pound, if you spent your pound differently, would that make any difference? Yeah. It wouldn't at the end of the day because it's all so interpolated that it doesn't.
Emma?
I mostly agree with all of that. I think the fact of the matter is we're going to a general election incredibly soon. And having worked in this area for a while now, we know that this doesn't come at the top of what voters want to talk about in terms of kind of the economy, food banks, jobs, immigration. But the only way that anything is going to even marginally change towards what I think the people in this room wanted to go towards is if you talk to your candidates about it, to let them know that this is an issue that might not be at the very top of your agenda in terms of what you wake up and think about in the morning, but it is important. I think part of the problem in this country that we haven't seen a huge amount of change is because we've been incredibly passive towards it, in part because of the history that we have in this country and compared to the countries not too far away from us. But the difference is huge. I think politicians don't think that this matters to you. And we know that that's not true. We know from the polling that's not true. I know that from talking to people. At the moment that anybody individually feels that their privacy is invaded upon, it really does certainly matter to them. So the only thing that on a practical level that I can encourage you to do in the immediate kind of future is to actually start talking about this with them, and then hopefully we can have a government, whoever we end up with in the next parliament, who are fully aware that this has got to be on their agenda. They have to be talking about this in an informed way. We're absolutely going to have some new surveillance legislation passed through our parliament in the next 18 months because of the sunset clause that's associated with the Data Retention and Investigatory Powers Act. So let's make sure that we have this as an informed debate. And let's make sure that they know that this has to be an informed debate, that they can't get away with pushing through this sort of legislation in 3 days without not even a debate within Parliament, never mind a debate with the public. If we don't do that as citizens, as individuals, then we get what we deserve, quite frankly.
Okay, we've looked at this from a surveillance perspective, from a global political establishment perspective. I want to talk a little bit about big data and the benefits we might derive from it. So if we think about, for example, the medical context, where if we make medical data available in a centralized pot for researchers to look into, we can do anything from curing cancer to any disease that we can think about in all parts of the world. So why not just make our medical data available to the researchers and let them get on with it? The government, the UK government, are trying to do this in the 100 Genomes Project, through the Care Data Scheme, etc. What kind of issues do we have with that?
Well, the Care Data Scheme is incredibly interesting, and Big Brother Watch was one of the organisations who fought for quite a long time to make sure that people were even able to get an opt-out. At the point of it being designed as a project, we weren't barely even going to be told that it was happening. It was just going to happen, and it might get reported on a little bit in the press. But we thought there's an organisation that if there's any other NHS organisation, insurance company, researcher, whoever, who might potentially get access to our medical records, that we have the right to know. Medical data is incredibly interesting because I think people have an incredibly traditional outlook on privacy and medical data in comparison to any other information that we're involved with. They see it very in a traditional way that is a transaction between you and your doctor, and that confidentiality is incredibly important. And if anybody else has access to that for outside of reasonable means, then people get very upset. And so with care.data, one of the reasons why it failed is because NHS England decided to communicate all of this, talk about anonymisation, talk about secondary care, talk about third parties in the NHS when nobody really seems to be able to define what the NHS is anymore, and do it on a two-page generic-looking leaflet. There was no opt-out for people who couldn't see or hear properly, who didn't speak English as their first language. You had to go to the GP and you had to give them a letter or orally say to them, I don't want to be involved in this. Some people were getting mixed up with primary care, so they thought that if they opted out of this then and you went to hospital, you weren't going to get the same sort of care. It was a complete disaster, and whenever we're involved in any conversations with any big data project or a perceived big data project, as that seems to be the buzzword in government these days, when actually they don't mean big data at all, care data is always cited as the disaster that we need to avoid. I don't think there's no problem as an individual if I want to share my medical data to help with medical research, if I want to donate my body when I die to medical research, if I'm fully informed with what that entails and that what impact that's going to have on me and on society as a whole, then that's grand. But it's when, in any of these situations, you feel as an individual that things are being done to you rather than with you, I think that's when people start getting quite upset.
Okay. Stephen?
I probably agree with most of that. I think the question to ask whenever big data comes up is who's going to have access to the data, why, when, how will we know that they've got access to the data, which kind of touches on what Emma said. This is particularly true when we think about medical data. At the moment in Scotland, they're trying to push through they're having a consultation, but we know what that means. They're having a consultation on linking up. Everyone at birth is assigned I can't remember the name for it, but there's an ID number basically, and they use this to tally you to your NHS treatment, so GP, etc. And at the moment, there's a move to tie that number into a central database, which would then be accessible by a whole host of people, organisations that have been selected. Some of them make sense. Some of them are hospital trusts, stuff like that. But if you look at the long list in the consultation, the people that will have access to the, not necessarily to the data at this point, because they tell us they're not going to give access to the data, just the number. But the other organisations include the Edinburgh Royal Botanical Gardens, the Good Meat, I can't remember the name of them, the Meat Standards Association, like really bizarre organisations that have got no reason to have any link to medical data whatsoever. And I think that the fact that the civil service want to see, they want to solve a problem, and they see that by mashing more data together, but they don't really know what problem they're trying to solve and how, and they don't really think of it in terms of privacy, because they're like, well, this will have benefits, because then we won't have to, you know, look for tax evaders, because we can join them up to their NHS record, and it just doesn't even figure into their thinking, which is why good meat, you know, the meat hygiene people are on the list. So for that reason, I wouldn't trust them with anything.
So we have, how do we get to figure out their thinking? What Stephen's saying is, basically coming back to what you're saying, Vinay, is there's a lot of incompetence in the establishment running these projects.
I mean, there's incompetence, but let us not forget the role of evil. Right? The reference point for me on this is a book called IBM and the Holocaust, which asks, where did Hitler get the names of the Jews? How did they figure out who was Jewish? The answer is, IBM was selling them punch card tabulating machines, and they were crunching all of the available genealogical data into those machines to select out the part of the population they were going to kill. Right? So we're in a position right now where we have no idea, if that threat comes again in a different form, what will be the selective characteristic that will get you nailed, right? And I would suggest that we are 10 to 20 years away from personalized genetic medicine, where your doctor will take a DNA sample, run it through, look for a bunch of questionable genes, and if you have them, they'll change your care. For example, Angelina Jolie has had a bunch of surgery to remove, to lower her cancer risk, because she's very predisposed to certain kinds of cancer. Right? So if you take an environment where your doctor has a DNA sample and is running genetic medicine, what do you think the odds are that we could find behavioral cues? Tendency towards violent crime, sociopathy, psychopathy, tendency towards extremely expensive medical procedures. There could be a range of genetic factors that a future government would then begin to use for differentiating treatment, up to and including withholding medical care, forcing people into private health insurance, or just shooting the bastards. And we're not making these decisions for ourselves, we're making these decisions for our children and our grandchildren, because the policies will last for decades, and you make a policy when technology is here, the policy stays roughly the same, and the technology goes like this up the exponential curve. So we have to be thinking 20 to 30 years in the future, million or 10 million times more computing power, liberal and easy access to DNA testing. And in that kind of environment, for God's sake, do not let people put your genome on a computer. So unless you have a government you can trust, which we don't.
If you can't put your genome on a computer, you can't derive the benefits of the medical research that's gone to it. You don't know.
This is the ratchet. Until you have government that you can trust, you can't have nice things. Right?
Well, I mean, you can't change human nature. I mean, humanity is we use excuses to discriminate against categories of people regardless of who and where we are.
Look,
if you give them more and more categories through big data, are you just going to see more and more discrimination?
Look, the state killed 250 million people in the 20th century, and a lot of that was data-driven and intelligence-driven. In the German case, data-driven. In the Stalin case, it was surveillance and report from your neighbours. Right? Mao, Pol Pot, slightly different, right? So the largest threat to human life in the 20th century wasn't war. 10 times more people died in genocides than wars. And if you go down through the list of things that happened in Germany in the 1930s and compare them to America in the last 10 years, you will panic, right? So we keep framing this debate as if we were dealing with a status quo situation. We're not dealing with a status quo situation. We're dealing with a global urgent crisis, which is high-tech fascism, as a real political risk. Whether it's 1932, 1925, or 1938, we don't know, but that threat has not receded. Guantanamo Bay is not closed. The US intelligence systems are not reined in. Nobody's gone to jail for lying to Congress about the risk from Iraq. Right? And in that context, let us assume a fundamentally untrustworthy state and then discuss what we do with our medical records.
I guess one of the ways to summarise in terms of big data is that big data is in itself pretty, it's just data. It's about the intentions of the person who wields that data. It can be as kind of benign or as intrusive. but it's to do with human nature. I think whenever we talk about big data, it sometimes comes across that just the collection of that data in itself is a bad thing. It's not. It's the human intention behind it.
Okay. Vinny, you mentioned Angelina Jolie, and just coming back to that in the context of the libertarian thing. If we take politics out of it, if we take the political establishment out of it, and we can hand that over to the marketplace, you've still got an issue here, because Jolie discovered she had a mutation of BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, which indicated predisposition towards contracting certain kinds of cancer, and she decided to deal with it preemptively.
I think she'd had maybe two or three members of her family who died very young.
We have a company in the US, Myriad Genetics, who has a patent on the mutations and the tests for these genes. And they've had a history of, let's say, discouraging medical researchers and other companies from engaging in research and rolling out the lawyers to do so. It suggests that the sort of the free market in this context may not be a solution to sort of the big data in the medical context.
Well, so, I mean, patents have nothing at all to do with the free market, right? They're a creation of a monopoly. They're a creation of a monopoly by state fiat, and then a grant of that monopoly to an individual, right? The patent is explicitly the government creation of a monopoly. It's not a market instrument. Limited liability, not a market instrument. It's a government fiat that moves risk from creditors to investors. Copyright, not a market instrument. Again, it's government creation of monopoly. These are just not market tools.
Okay, Stephen?
What was the question again?
Okay, I'll tell you what. I'm going to open it up to the audience at this point. Is anybody getting specific questions? Could you say who you are, what your affiliation is, and if the question is directed at any particular member of the panel? Gentleman here with the glasses.
Hi, my name's Rob. I'm a software developer, and I currently work on a government project. I suppose my question is that we have this sort of Hayekian problem with big data in terms of mass surveillance, in that it's all well and good the government collecting all this data, but they have a serious signal-to-noise problem, which you raised, which is even if they have this data, they're not spotting anything useful from it, because simply the ability to process that data is almost impossible, given how quickly it grows every single day. So that makes me think that the whole process is almost pointless. Okay, so it seems pointless to me that it's being done because it can't help us. And then what I'm really interested in is the chap in the middle. Why? What is driving this? What is the ideological position of these people? Why are they pursuing these aims? I'd like to know a bit more about that.
Okay, so my best guess is very simple. My best guess is that the American government is very afraid of nanotechnology, biotechnology, and basically this kind of notion of the ability of small groups of people to create threats that are more dangerous than nuclear weapons. And that they're attempting to interdict that threat early by getting complete control of the world's technological infrastructure. And I can sit down on a whiteboard and show you reasons why that's a perfectly rational thing to do. It's hard to argue against when you get realistic about those threats. They're not here yet, they're over the horizon, but 30-year planning is normal at the Pentagon. This, however, is coupled with a whole bunch of other extraordinarily stupid and evil political agendas. Oil lobbies, the desire for the American public to still consume 5 to 10 times their share of the world's natural resources, the enormous pigs at the trough frenzy of military procurement, where Congress keeps buying expensive weapons for the Pentagon that they've asked them to stop buying, like main battle tanks, because they never believe they're going to use them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what you're dealing with is a bunch of extraordinarily powerful entities with enormous reach,
some of which are kind of rational evil, but potentially very protective of the future of humanity, and the others of which are basically just a bunch of idiotic, more, you know, trolls running around in the taxpayers' dollars causing mayhem. But it is a mixed agenda. I do not believe that the push towards authoritarianism is in any way a concerted effort. I don't believe the conspiracy theory of history on this, but it is a combination of rational and stupid forces in this kind of hybrid form that kind of brings out the worst in both. And the population is unbelievably complacent because they just won't embrace the kind of Gandhian agenda, satyagraha, tell the truth about the conditions on the other end of the supply chain. If you want to see fairness and social justice, try and buy a Macintosh that has no slavery inside. And if the public were more willing to do that, we could get most of the global justice concerns that we have sorted out inside of the market. It's just the public are too greedy to care about the slaves.
Can anything to add?
I guess in terms of kind of the non-ideological side of your question, it comes down to the argument on the two sides of, do you need to build the haystack to find the needle, or the bigger the haystack you build, does it make it less likely you're going to find any needle? And that comes down, I guess, to the, is bulk data collection mass surveillance, is mass surveillance bulk data collection? I think this, I don't think either side thinks that there's anything wrong with the argument that they're making. I don't think anybody who makes the argument for building the bigger haystack, certainly the people that I deal with on a day-to-day basis, are doing it because they think that it's the wrong thing to do. They think they're doing it to make society better, whereas I make the argument that it's harmful because I think that's going to make society better. I don't think there's any evilness on either side. I think it's just a difference of opinion, and it's a debate that's going to go on for an incredibly long time.
They can't even build a little haystack. My
experience. So. Should I feel better? Should I sleep easier at night now?
The incompetence level, even on a small project like I work on, is unbelievable. So, yeah.
I think there's some sort of fetish for data collection almost, especially within government. I mean, if you look at the likes of Google and tech companies, they want to hang on to data, and I mean, it's obvious why, because they make money off it. But in terms of the public sector, the people that I know, at least in the public sector, get this idea that one day it will be useful. Like, even if they don't know why now, they're like, well, if we keep all this postcode data and link it up to fingerprints, then, well, maybe we'll be able to do something. And they, once you've collected some, they're really, it's like hoarding. You don't want to get rid of some once they've worked to get it, because it's valuable. I mean, that's outside of the ideological concerns, but. I think the answer is a lot of people don't know why they want it. They just want to have the data because it's an asset to have.
There is a beautiful book that explains some of this thinking. It's from the 1970s called Designing Freedom by a guy called Stafford Beer.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Terrific.
Rare. Yeah. Right? And it's an absolute classic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you want to give them a nickel summary of why they should read it?
No. It's 20 years since I read Beer, so I couldn't give a nickel summary.
So the nutshell version is this. It's basically a series of essays that explain how bureaucracies adopt computers. And all of the things that he describes are still happening today, and it's an absolutely lucid and beautiful little book. It's about 100 pages. Buy a copy. You'll love it.
Yeah. I had another question over here. Yeah.
Gus Caulfield, journalist at the Register. Maybe for Emma, I think, as well. When all the Snowden revelations came out in America, there was a big public pushback against it, not just little people like us, but elected politicians and so on were publicly saying, this is awful, this is scandalous. There's all the big tech companies like Google and Apple and Yahoo pushing back against it. But over here, we've seen little of that at all, or no public pushback. You mentioned that Dream went straight through in 3 days. Why do you think that is, and how can we change that?
I mean, there's a few different reasons. I think I briefly alluded to the fact that as a society, we don't necessarily have the history that some citizens, especially in Europe, have in terms of the potential use of data and the potential use of surveillance. They don't necessarily accept the, A, we can't talk about it because of national security, or B, we're doing it for your own good, arguments that have been made. I think in part it's happened because we've allowed it to happen. in terms of the reaction. I think there wasn't as much as an outcry, certainly within the media, for, I mean, I think people have different theories as to why the majority of the media in this country didn't run with the stories like we saw multiple national newspapers doing in America and across Europe. And of course, that obviously, as I said earlier, if the media are upset about something and if the public are upset about something, politicians tend to do something. It's kind of how it works. I think in this country, the politicians would argue that they did do something. The ISC published an emergency report, which I think was 2 pages, maybe 4. I'll maybe give them 4, in terms of the clean bill of health that was given post-known. We've had the ISC report, which, again, was a mixed bag. We've got David Anderson, who's the independent review of terrorism legislation. His report's going to be on whoever's prime minister's desk the day that he starts. And we've got the RUSI report investigation into this as well. If you compare that to what's been going on in Germany, the last conversation I had with somebody in the government there was that their version of the ISC investigation is going to take about 3 years, because anyone who goes and gives evidence is allowed to speak for basically as long as they want. The panel I get was on lasted for about an hour and a half, and we spend an awful long time debating the merits of mass surveillance and about 15 minutes on the problems with authorization, oversight and redress. It kind of highlights the difference in opinion to what we have over here. I would like to think that this is going to become more in the public domain because of the legislation that we're going to face over the next 18 months, but that's only really going to happen if we get informed and knowledgeable politicians. And I know in the 2010 intake, we had a lot more politicians come in who from a slightly more techie engineering background. I hope that happens again, but it's still not going to be quite on the scale that we need it to be.
Emma with glasses.
My question to Emma would be, if we're concerned that the government isn't being completely open with us, that it is doing things that it would rather not tell us about, it's doing things that are illegal, it has a precedent for doing this and keeping us in the dark, then to what extent can we reasonably believe that we can reform the system that